anything that does good, there's also a real potential for harm to be done. And I went through that growing up as a queer kid in Eastern Kentucky.
From 89.3 WFPL and Louisville Public Media, this is Five Things, the show that tells a life story through the objects we treasure. I'm Tara Anderson. On each episode, we'll hear about five physical objects that are significant to our guest, from the exceptional to the everyday, inexpensive or priceless, carried every day or lost forever. The objects we love can define what's important. This week's guest is an artist and an activist born and raised in Breathitt County, Kentucky. He's currently the CEO and co-founder of Ideas X Lab in Louisville, which trains artists to work in the health sector. And instead of talking in the studio here at Louisville Public Media, where I usually do these interviews, he asked me to meet him in a place that's special to him.
My name is Theo Edmonds. I am an artist, a native Kentuckian, a southerner, and a person of the 21st century who's working toward a better future.
Tell us where we are.
We're in my art studio over in the Portland area of Louisville, Kentucky.
Can you describe this space visually?
Sure. Well, it's a big warehouse space with white walls and lots of very, very colorful, large paintings on the wall. When I paint, I like to paint on the wall, and I put the canvas up there because painting for me is like a performance, and so that's why my paintings are large, because I'm literally physically engaging with my surroundings as I paint, and like the painting that's left over is really the artifact of that. It's not so much an object that I was seeking to create.
So we're here in your studio, and you told me that this studio is one of your five things that define your life or have been important to you. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So when I was growing up, I grew up in Eastern Kentucky, and you know, I loved to go out into the woods and stuff when I was a kid, because it was where I would process, and you know, whether it was building or like taking sticks and stuff that I found around and creating stuff with them. That was really important to me. And then also I was a clogger growing up, and the dancing studio where I was always in was always very important to me. So between that nature studio and the dancing studio, a place where I'm creative has always been a piece of me. And so I went through a period of life. Well, I graduated from college very early, and by the time I was 26, I had a law degree and a master's in healthcare administration, and I was running one of the biggest heart centers in the country in New Orleans. And so I'm a strategist, and I'm really good at figuring out how things go together that other people just don't quite see how they fit. And that's why a lot of my art is installation. But I went through a number of years just in the corporate world. And I didn't create, and I didn't write. And I rose to a very, very high level very quickly. And when I got there, I was really, really unhappy, because I hadn't really created anything of my own or tapped into that thing that is such an important part of my own experience. And when I didn't do that, you know, it caused me to make a lot of wrong decisions in my life. I went through a couple really hard years of just trying to figure out what my life was supposed to be about. And so during that time, I decided I would get back into a studio. And I did, and one thing led to another, and here we are today. So the studio is a place that I always come to center myself.
How do you feel when you walk through the door here?
Excited. Like there's not enough time in the day to get everything out of me that that I want to get out and I want to say, and then also equally relaxed. And so it's this weird kind of yin and yang thing where, you know, it's this balance that it's a tension, but it's a perfect tension, and it's comfortable because it's the push and the pull in harmony together. And that's rarely where I think a lot of people, myself for sure, find myself most days in my life. I'm either pushing or pulling, but never really in that kind of harmony that I feel here.
I'm curious, what do you wear when you're working?
I have got I've got two or three pairs of old shorts and overalls that are so stiff from dry paint they could stand up and probably walk across the room on themselves. So
overalls.
Yeah.
What is it with overalls?
I'm from Eastern Kentucky. You know, I'm a proud hillbilly. What can I say? It's part of our costume.
But it must be something you feel comfortable in, right?
Yeah, I do. Especially in the summertime, because it's nice to be able to paint without a shirt on or something. And the sweat and so forth, the studio and the dirt, and that's all part of it for me. It doesn't really bother me. But the overalls also, when I'm not thinking about it and I'm wiping my wiping my hand like on my chest, you know, and there's no shirt there, it can get a little messy. So the overalls help go with the cleanup afterwards.
So this is your first object, so to speak, is your studio, the place we're in. What's your next one?
Let's see, no particular order. I brought along a book that I've had since I was, it's one of the first books I ever remember, and it was funny, when I pulled it out of the closet, I had written on this book, "I will love this book always." And it, like, I can tell just by the handwriting, I had barely learned how to write at that point. But it's called The Book of Giant Stories, and it's a beautiful illustrated book by a French artist named Philippe Fix. And it is just this book of stories about a little boy and his interaction with this world of giants. And he's neither scared of them nor them of him, but they're wary of each other. And so there's this kind of imperfect truce that they're always going from one side of the other to. But more often than not, they end up helping each other. Sometimes he helps them, sometimes they help him, and sometimes they band together to, you know, fight a common enemy. But I've always really appreciated the kind of fantasy relationship that this book presents.
Do you have a favorite passage?
Oh, let's see. It's going to take me a second to find.
How old do you think you were when you first got this book? You said maybe when you just learned to write. So
it's the first book that I can ever remember having. It was this one and one other. Even when I couldn't read it, it was the pictures. My dad would read it to me. So give me one second here. So, okay, there's this one story about the little boy teaching the giant, more than anything, the giant wanted to learn how to whistle. And so the little boy taught the big giant how to whistle, which is such a little boy thing, but it's the one thing that the big giant really wanted to learn how to do. And so toward the end of it, they're both putting their finger up to their mouth, and the little boy is telling the giant, just blow, blow. And so the giant does. The giant looked as if he didn't believe it. He puckered his lips into an O and he blew. And out came a long, low whistle. It sounded like a freight train locomotive, and the giant smiled. He shouted, "I whistled! Did you hear that? I whistled!" And taking the little boy's hand, he danced in a circle. "You're a good friend," said the giant. "Thank you," said the little boy. "Sometimes maybe we can whistle together, but right now I have to go. It's my supper time."
You said you remember your father reading this to you. What was he like? Did he read to you often?
Yeah, I've got a really good dad. He read to me a lot. My dad and my grandmother are really similar to each other. My grandmother's 98 years old. And one of the many, many things that the three of us have in common is our watery eyes. We get very tender really quickly on when we see certain things, and very angry when we see injustice sometimes. But I remember, Dad, when he would read to me, he would always kind of get a little choked up at the end and get the watery eyes. Not cry, not at all crying. It was just like, it was a connection.
How is it that this book is still in your possession? Do you remember when you took it out of your parents' home, or did you find it later?
About 4 years ago, I was home and I was going through some old stuff and I found it. And so then I asked Mom and Dad and if I could and brought it back to my house.
Do they still live in the same place where you grew up?
Yeah, they do. They're in Breathitt County in Jackson, Kentucky.
What kind of house is it?
It's a brick house. It's in a big field, and on the other end of the field is where my uncle and aunt live. And in between my uncle and aunt's house and my parents' house, my grandmother has a little home. So she's still living alone at 98, but there between her two sons in this little valley.
So it sounds like you grew up with a very close family.
Yeah, we had a very tight-knit family. Education was a very big value in our family. My father was an educator. He went on to spend many years as state representative from the county and the neighboring counties that we're from. But most of his life, he was an educator and a school teacher.
I'm curious about you. You referred to yourself as a hillbilly. What's that word mean to you?
It means someone who is... it's my family. It's when I think about my family, we're a Scotch, Irish, Cherokee. My grandfather came from Alabama, but other than him on my dad's side of the family, everybody is from the mountains of eastern Kentucky. And so when I hear the word hillbilly, I think about the people that I love and the line of people that I come from. I know it's often used in a derogatory way. That's other people's stuff. That's not mine. So sometimes when people don't know what else to say or when they're confused by something, they often take the short way out and go to one word or something like that just captures a whole bunch of stuff that they don't understand. It's shorthand for, hey, I'm not willing to do the work to get to know these people.
As someone who is from Eastern Kentucky and has lived a lot of different places and worked with a lot of different people, have you found yourself having to counter other people's expectations of you because of where you're from?
You know, it's interesting. When I was in the corporate world, and this was in New Orleans, it always worked to my advantage in the boardroom. In fact, I would often thicken up the accent just a little bit because I knew when I did that I was always going to be underestimated. And so actually I found that I could use that to my advantage. It's funny how people underestimate other people just because of the way they look or the way they sound or something like that. I've been back in Kentucky 4 years, but for most of my life, I've been, you know, out of Kentucky more than I've been in Kentucky really through my life. I was here till I was 19 and then I left. And then I basically came back, in my young 40s.
Do you think this is where you're going to stay?
For the time being, yeah, sure, absolutely. Who's to say what the future holds? I think that Kentucky's a really interesting place right now, and I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done here. And being a gay man who's, in his late 40s, I remember what the 80s were like with the AIDS crisis and so forth. And I remember the culture wars. And I look at what's going on with our politics right now. And, just the other day, I was in the religious freedom bill that the Senate passed, Kentucky Senate passed this year. I pulled out the language and looked at it, because I'm a lawyer, so I've still got that thing is inside me, too. And under protected activities, they had listed in there, among other things, creative and artistic expression right beside spiritual and religious goods. And I thought the phrasing of those things in protected class activities was one of the most strangest things I've ever seen in my life. And so if Kentucky is a place where there is this blending of culture and arts and creative expression and religion And me being of a certain age, when I have seen and gone through places where religion has caused a lot of people a lot of damage, I'm not a religion basher at all. In fact, I consider myself a Christian, and that's how I self-identify. But I think that anything that does good, there's also a real potential for harm to be done. And I went through that growing up as a queer kid in Eastern Kentucky. And so to be in a place where there is the potential for me to be part of a solution that helps to protect other people, that helps to be part of something that builds capacity for understanding rather than more walls that keep us apart from each other, I think is a very important place for me to be right now. Speaking of my grandmother, these books here are, they are, it's Breathitt County Memories, and it's a gentleman who's a friend of my family, Charles Hayes, who has compiled pictures and stories from the last 150 years of the county, even more of the county. Some of them are contemporary stories, some of them are very old. They cover everything from the feuds to one-room schoolhouses to coal mining, all the way to things that are happening last year. In these books, my grandmother, when they first came out, my grandmother started taking them and then marking pages. And all these stories that were either friends of hers, that were her own personal stories, or things that she had memories of, and
there are pages that are folded in.
Yeah, and the pages that are folded in, you'll see in her handwriting things she's written. Her, like this picture here, is of Highland School. This is where my grandmother went, and she's 98. This is where she went from first grade to her, she graduated from high school. And so all through this book are different pieces of our county, and so she's written folded pages that she just either loves or that we have a family connection to, and she's written all of her personal observations in this book. So whenever I want to connect with her, I'm able to open this book and just kind of look at that.
She had a note on the school, on the picture of the school.
Yeah. It says, "Thank God for it. Many of us received an education from this building, a great place." Her and my granddad's little country store was literally 100 feet from this building. There was their store and the school. In the first 10 years of my life, the house that I spent the first 10 years of my life in was also on this, basically on the campus of this place. And then my grandparents sold their little country store in 1980 to retire. And when they did so, they moved less than a half mile up the creek to live in the house where my grandmother was born. Then after they sold the store in 1980, the school burned the following year. Then the store burned within 6 months of that. And now when you go to the community, kudzu has completely grown over everything. And right across from the school is the church where my parents were married in, my aunt and uncle. And on top of the hill behind the church is my family cemetery. But now when you go to the community, it's you know, you can see remnants like in artifacts of buildings that were there, but it's mostly just kudzu. So you would never know that there was even a community that was there. And so when you think about the implications of that and how things change over time, you know, we're all here for just a very short amount of time. And you know, it's too bad we have to do so much damage to each other in that time we're here sometimes. It's total non sequitur, but there was three girls that I danced with from the time I was about 6 years old. And at one point, we were the goodwill ambassadors for the state of Kentucky when we were clogging. And it was during the Martha Lane Collins administration. She literally sent us around the world dancing to promote Kentucky arts and crafts. And there was three girls I danced with. One of them, Scarlett, she and I walked into kindergarten hand in hand on the first day, senior year of high school, we graduated. Scarlett went on to become the head of pharmacy for the most important equine hospital in the country, out of Lexington. And then early, I guess in the second week of January last year, she called me. And by June, I was attending her funeral. She had a massive brain cancer. And so that has, you know, I think a lot of my most important learning is still coming today, because you live long enough, you play all the parts. And at 46, you know, and going through that with Scarlett, and then there was another very, very dear friend of mine who was one of my first romantic interests ever in my life in high school. You know, he had really hard time with his family because he was gay, and he had trouble with, long-term trouble with alcohol and stuff, and he ended up killing himself a couple years ago. And so, you know, you wonder sometimes like how you survive certain periods of your life when it really, if you're reading about it in a book or watching a movie, you're like, there's no way they're going to get through that. You know, I'm on the other side of that. And some people that should have made it didn't. And some people, and some people are still struggling with that, you know, day to day. And I think a lot about these days, the tone of our politics in this country. And I look at all of the positive things that we could do if we were working together. And we still seem like just hell-bent on this kind of power grab with each other. And that, I think a lot about that these days.
My grandfather told me that one of the worst things about getting old is all your friends are dead. I don't know why that's funny.
It is. It's one of my dearest friends, Alicia, her mother had an uncle that was one of those individuals that always had a great quote for everything. And somebody asked him one time, one of his best friends had just died, and somebody asked him one time, said, aren't you going to their funeral? And he said, well, he's not coming to mine.
You mentioned it was challenging growing up as a queer kid in Eastern Kentucky. How did your own family react to that part of you?
It was tough. It was really tough. I think one of the most important things for people to realize is if in this whole religion debate that goes on around gay folks, if you tell individuals that faith should be important to them, then once they believe that, then you tell them that faith says that they cannot be how they were created. You have just created a disassociation between a person and their own skin. You've created a situation where the act of love becomes this radical political act. And so what is the impact of a generation or generations of people holding that kind of tension and that stress in their body year after year? What does that do to the cultural memory? Then no wonder it is so, no wonder that the rates of drug, alcohol abuse, depression, suicide in the LGBT population are as high as they are. You look at, you know, I see in many ways, and I'm not comparing here, but I do see similarities between a lot of the African-American community, and especially on the health side, and the gay community. Because I was listening to this mother, African-American mother with three sons, and she was talking about the tension that she has held in her body day in and day out, year after year, out of worry for her sons. I personally recognized that tension that she was talking about, because of my own reasons, in my own way, and from my own lived experience, I understood what that is. And so when we're creating a society that forces people to hold that kind of stress and that kind of tension, no wonder we have the kinds of health conditions that we have in this country right now. I mean, we spend more on health care than any other thing in this country, and we have the worst health outcomes. So it's got to be about more than just the medical services we're providing. You know, the isms are literally killing us as a country. We are killing ourselves through racism, through heteroism, through sexism. You've got generations of young black men have been taken out of the family because of some of our political policies around mass incarceration. And yet, so we've ended up with a generation of single-parent household mothers in the workplace. They can't earn the same as their male counterparts because of sexism. And then they're forced. It just is crazy to me. And this is what we accept as the norm. This is what we accept as the norm. When do we change that? When does that not become okay?
I'm going to guess. You tell me if I'm wrong. The place where you grew up was a pretty white area.
Oh, yeah.
Was there anybody of color around you when you were growing up?
Yes, there were a lot of folks from Native American heritage, because there was, in the area, Eastern Kentucky, where I grew up, there's a lot of Cherokee. There were no Latinos. There were no Asians. And from an African American standpoint, there were three.
And now a lot of your work is in an African American community. How do you address your white privilege? How do you wear it? How do you work with it, with the work that you do?
Head on and intentionally. I did not create white privilege, but I benefit from it. And so just acknowledging that is the best place for me to start with that.
Do you remember when how you got to understand that white privilege is even something that exists?
Honestly, I think it's only been in the last probably 5 years that I've really fully come to appreciate that. And I've noticed it. I'm just going to say it. I've noticed it in the arts, and that's how I've learned about it probably more than any other place. The arts should be leading the way, not being afraid to not even make a statement on cultural equity because we're afraid that it is going to impact our ability to fundraise. Let me say that again. The arts should be leading the way, not being scared of an important conversation that is affecting people's lives because we're afraid it's going to affect our ability to fundraise. But yet, that's where we are in Louisville, Kentucky. That's where we are in a lot of cities across America. It's not an easy thing. I understand that. But the easy thing has never been the thing that interests artists the most. So just as an artist, if you're not continually putting yourself in an uncomfortable place, if you're not continually pushing against the edge of the frontier of knowledge that you already have, you're a bullshit artist. And there's a lot of bullshit going around.
How do you check your own bullshit?
Because of the work we do, I'm continually in a place where other people are checking it for me. So how do I check it? I continually keep showing up and being consistent in places, even where it is where I'm being called on my own bullshit. The easy answer is to walk away. A thought that has occurred to me quite a bit lately is, I think when I'm getting tired, it's like, oh my God, I just can't go into this again. Like, here we go. Like, I'm getting ready to get beat up again and so forth. But, you know, my African-American friends don't have the luxury of just being able to walk away from it. I think about that a lot, and that propels me on. I am by no means holding myself out there as the guy who's got it right, because Lord knows most days I get it mostly wrong. But I keep showing up again the next day. So this is number four. It's a silver goblet that's about the size of a big mug. And on one side of it, the handle for the mug is made to look, it's like a jester clown with his hand over the edge of the mug getting ready to drop a dice into the glass. And so that's the handle. And then on the other side of the mug at the edge is a little silver monkey with his hand over, like dipping into the glass. And I got this, one of my best girlfriends in the world, her name is Sabrina, and she lives in Texas. We were deadheads together in college. We got this mug at a Renaissance fair. And there's this picture of me. I had a, well, you know those big, huge turkey legs they have? So I had the big turkey leg in one hand. I had this mug in my other hand full of beer. And it was just, I was sitting by a tree. And I had these little, like, horns that you, like, whatever the mythological character. Anyway.
Pan?
Yeah, like Pan. I had these little horns that I had bought, like, on. So I'm sitting there with those horns on and this mug and this big turkey leg. And there's this picture that Sabrina has of me doing this, and it's just one of my favorite pictures in the world, because that day was so, as many days that Sabrina and I had throughout our life, was completely off the wall. There's no rhyme, reason, or logic to any of it. This mug is now what I keep my pencils and my pens in, and it sits back in my computer every single day, and every time I reach for a pen, I smile, because life is kind of absurd.
It's a really crazy mug.
And I have to say, if I had the opportunity tomorrow, I would be sitting by a tree with a turkey leg and this mug and horns in my head, drinking a cold beer. Why not? Yeah.
Tell me about Sabrina.
Oh, God, Sabrina. The first time I met her, I was a theater major in college, and the first time I met her was at this after party for one of the shows that we had just done. And this girl walks into the room. She's got this like blonde frizzy hair that is just, like, if you hold your arms out to your side, the hair came out that big. Bright neon leggings and these, we called them the witchy poo shoes. These shoes, patent leather shoes that came out to this massive point. You know, this was like the days of like Delight and, you know, the B-52. So it was that kind of like style. And I just remember she comes into the room and put on Donna Summers. And I'm like, I don't know who you are, but you and I are going to be good friends. And like from that day, literally from that day forward, it just was effortless. And I have... She and her husband have been married for 15, 20 years now. I went with them on their first date. Their daughter is just graduating from high school. They have a younger son, Lucian. And when Lucian was born, he was one of two twins. They found out about 3 months before Lucian was born that his other twin was going to be stillborn. But so Sabrina had to carry that to term. And they had... Lucian's brother cremated, and Sabrina called me one day and she says, I would like for you to take some of the ashes and create a painting that we can hang in Lucian's room and for him to have all his life. So that was one of the most special weekends I've ever had in my life. It was scary.
So how did you approach it?
As a friend.
And it's there in his room now. Yeah. I can tell that's something that meant a lot to you. Yeah.
Sabrina and I have been through it all. And through it all, laughter is like, there is no person in the world I laugh harder with than I do with her. Last thing is not a thing, but things. I brought all of my journals from the last 10 years, and then a book that has all of my creative ideas from the last 10 years with me. In this stack of this, there's two black ones, a brown one, and two red ones, and then a big book that's probably got, I don't know, 300 pages in it, maybe? Maybe not that many. But these are all just ideas and poems and fragments and some completed works that just haven't been polished yet, that I keep. Sometimes I'll go back through them, and it helps me to go back to a place or an emotion or a moment that I may have forgotten about. And I think those things are really important, because we get hit with so much on any given day. If we don't write things down, I think there's the possibility of losing things that are there to teach us. That's what these books represent, both life lessons and creative ones.
Are they private? I'm not asking to look, but is there anybody that you share this stuff with?
No, I haven't really at all. Let's see, I don't even know what's in here. Here, let's just open a page. Everything is a mirror if you look at it long enough. It's everything from that to, here's an attempt to sketch a Jackson Pollock from visiting a museum. Here's a beginning of a poem called Flophouse Hooligan. It literally is anything and everything. And also in this one here, the big one, is where I keep Josh and I, my partner. We write, instead of giving each other presents at anniversaries and Christmas and stuff, we write each other a letter. And so this is where I keep those letters also.
That's a lovely tradition. How long have you all been together?
This going to be our fourth anniversary, our next one.
And how did you two meet?
Art, as always, plays into it. We were introduced to each other by the director of development for Kentucky School of Art, which is now KiKED.
Did she introduce you to each other deliberately, like, I think you all should know each other, or did it just...
So Josh is sitting over there. So Josh, you can weigh in on this one if you want to. He says this is not true, but I think it is. We were on the third date before I really realized that we were out on a date. He and Megan conspired to set us up. And I canceled on him three times.
Why did you cancel?
I was just like, who is this person? I don't know this person. I'm too busy. I can't, I got stuff to do. I can't be having lunch with just any random person Megan wants to introduce me to.
So, were you single at the time?
Yeah.
Were you looking for somebody to be with, or?
Who's not always open to meeting your best friend?
So you were on the third date before you realized it was a date. What were you all doing on that third date? Where'd you go?
We were at Wiltshire Pantry. It was a kind of a cold night out. I think we were the only ones in the restaurant that night, almost. It's on a Sunday night.
Maybe you don't want to answer this question. What happened to make you realize it was a date?
It was the kiss on the street afterwards. So this is from a poem or a piece of a poem that I wrote a lot of years ago. And it was for a show that I was working on with one of Warhol's superstars. Her name is Penny Arcade. And the piece was called The Disappearance of Butterflies. And it was looking at how myths are always told from the hero's perspective, but we very rarely stop to think about the monster and how hard it must be for the monster when everybody's rooting for the hero, and how did the monster become that, or even if he is a monster, if that's just what the hero has been able to tell. And so this is from The Disappearance of Butterflies. There are things that shadows leave behind. From inside those things, a monster, some days, carefully crawls out from his safe and lovely labyrinth into threadbare sunlight. And noticing, but pretending not to be hurt by the disappearance of butterflies, he picks up where he left off, values every kiss, and makes poetry with nails.
What does that mean to you?
I think it means that the hard work of life is to be soft with ourselves and with others.
That is really hard work.
It is. But so worth the effort.
You've been listening to Five Things, a production of 89.3 WFPL and Louisville Public Media. Thanks to our guest this week, Theo Edmonds. You can find out more about him and his work at theoedmonds.com. I'm Tara Anderson. Today's show was produced, edited, and mixed by me. Executive producer is Stephen George. We had music today from Jesse Spillan, BOPD, Josh Woodward, and Jazzar. And our theme music is by Alex Wright. You can get more information on our show at wfpl.org. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.